The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the January 30th, 2026 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week, we see a polar bear with a surprised look on his face. There's a snowy background, bright blue sky. He's holding in one of his paws a NATO flag, and he's wearing a button that says Yankee Go Home. Out of the side, we see just the forearm of a suited forearm, it looks like probably President Trump, in his hand as he's got a pistol to the polar bear's head. The headline is, "The Art of the Deal. Did Trump's threats get results in Greenland?" That's our first story. We'll start with that. Trump steps back from brink on Greenland. What happened? President Trump this week sparked a transatlantic crisis by sharply ramping up his demands for a U.S. takeover of Greenland, before abruptly shifting gears and announcing he'd struck the framework of a future deal on the Arctic territory with NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte. Over a tumultuous week, Trump unnerved European leaders with his threats to acquire the semi-autonomous Danish territory, population 57,000, one way or another, and to slap 10% tariffs on 8 NATO nations that opposed annexation. In a text to Norwegian Prime Minister Jonas Gahr Støre, he linked his push to acquire Greenland to being snubbed for the Nobel Peace Prize and said he no longer felt an obligation to think purely of peace. Addressing a packed conference hall at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, Trump said he wouldn't invade Greenland, which he argued was vital to U.S. security, but he insisted only America can defend the island, which he repeatedly referred to as Iceland, and demanded immediate negotiations on a U.S. takeover. Just hours later, Trump prompted global whiplash by calling off the tariffs, posting online that he and Rutte had arrived at a solution on Greenland that, if consummated, will be a great one for the United States of America and all NATO nations. Trump's shift came after tariff fears prompted Wall Street's worst day since October. And nations including France, Britain, and Norway sent small troop contingents to Greenland in a show of solidarity with Denmark. In Copenhagen and Greenland's capital, Nuuk, demonstrators marched through the streets chanting, "Yankee, go home." At Davos, stunned world leaders grappled with Trump's upending of the transatlantic alliance. French President Emmanuel Macron spoke of a world where imperial ambitions are resurfacing, while Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney drew a standing ovation for a speech in which he declared the end of a rules-based order underpinned by U.S. might and moral authority. "We are in the midst of a rupture," he said, "not a transition." Neither Trump nor Rutte offered specifics on the Greenland deal. The president told CNBC that it will involve European cooperation on his administration's proposed Golden Dome missile defense project, and they're going to be involved in mineral rights, and so are we. Trump called it the ultimate long-term deal. Asked how long that was, he replied, "Infinite. There is no time limit. It's a deal that's forever." What the columnist said. After days of saber-rattling, Trump backed down, said Lauren Aratani in The Guardian. The retreat came after his tariff threats prompted widespread apprehension, including warnings from Wall Street, and pushback from European leaders who declared they wouldn't allow themselves to be blackmailed. Hanging overhead was the threat from European leaders to deploy the so-called trade bazooka, a retaliatory measure that would let the bloc target almost all U.S. goods and services with restrictions and barriers. That prospect caused markets to sink, no doubt grabbing the attention of a president who pays close attention to stock movements. Trump's U-turn is welcome news, said Bloomberg in an editorial, but lasting harm has been done. With his bullying and threats, Trump has spooked our closest allies and empowered China and Russia, the very countries he claimed were plotting to seize the Danish territory. The damage he's done to NATO will be extremely difficult to repair and could well be permanent. Saner heads in the White House must make an attempt to patch up the alliance. And from now on, the administration urgently needs to rethink its approach to global relations, putting cooperation with friends first. Greenland is Trump's white whale, said Holman W. Jenkins, Jr. in the Wall Street Journal. And the foolishness of his obsession and willingness to engage in imperialist threats is a sign he needs therapy more than the U.S. needs the ice-strewn island. It's also a sign that at 79, he may be flirting with cognitive decline. There's no maybe about it, said Paul Krugman in his Substack newsletter. To read Trump's unhinged text to the Norwegian prime minister, full of false claims, grievances, and self-aggrandizement, is to see hard evidence that the American president is deeply unwell and rapidly getting sicker. As stunned European allies navigate a changing landscape, it's crucial not to sane-wash what's happening. America and the world are being held hostage to the whims of a petulant, violent, and deranged individual. What we're seeing is the essence of tyranny, said Andrew Sullivan in his Substack newsletter. The imposition of one man's will on an entire polity with no checks, balances, or even reasons cited to back him up. A U.S. takeover of Greenland is an insane idea that no Greenlander wants and that three-quarters of Americans oppose. Trump himself has given no coherent rationale for wanting it. Instead, he's spoken of the psychological benefit he'd derive from owning the territory. Essentially, he's upended the Western world out of pure solipsism and pursuit of personal glory. That's really all this is. Even if Trump's step back from the brink holds, something much bigger and perhaps unstoppable is now underway, said Jack Blanchard in Politico. Carney's Davos speech warning of rupture in the Western alliance went utterly viral, and for good reason. It spoke to the shock and burgeoning fear among allies who, for 80 years, have viewed American military protection and U.S. respect for a rules-based order as articles of faith. Even if Trump's Greenland adventure ends without a hostile takeover, that illusion has been shattered, and there's no going back. Controversy of the week. ICE, now a lawless agency. ICE's operation in Minneapolis is looking more and more like a siege on a city than an effort to enforce the law there, said Zeeshan Aleem in MS.Now. 11 days after an ICE agent shot and killed Renee Good on a residential street, masked immigration officers broke down the door of St. Paul resident Chongli Tao, a 56-year-old naturalized U.S. citizen with no criminal record, and dragged him out at gunpoint in handcuffs and boxer shorts in sub-freezing conditions. He was released an hour later. Sean and Destiny Jackson, both 26 and both American, were driving home from a child's basketball game when ICE blasted their car with tear gas and stun grenades, forcing them to perform CPR on their six-month-old baby. Local police chiefs are reporting that their own off-duty officers, the non-white ones specifically, have been stopped and asked for proof of citizenship. Nor are these aberrations. said Radley Balco in the New Republic. It is now routine for masked, unidentifiable government agents to sweep people off the street and whisk them away in unmarked vehicles. And any bystander who dares protest or record ICE's violence risk becoming a victim of it. To state the obvious, this isn't supposed to happen in a free society. But under President Trump, distinctions between the U.S. and the despotic regimes of history are getting harder and harder to make. ICE is the biggest cog in Trump's repressive machine, said Roque Planas in The Guardian. But every agency under Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem is joining the effort. That includes the Secret Service, Customs and Border Protection, and the Border Patrol, whose swaggering pint-sized commander-at-large, Gregory Bovino, now regularly shows up in cities far from the border. When the department was first constituted in the panicked aftermath of 9/11, there were bipartisan fears that we might be gifting some future autocrat the tools to control the American people, said Nick Miroff in The Atlantic. A quarter century later, Noem's DHS has become exactly what its critics feared. Americans mostly are horrified by what they see, said Kate Andrews in the Washington Post. Even before Good's killing, ICE's net approval rating was 14 points underwater, down 30 points a year. And only 38% of U.S. adults now approve of Trump's handling of immigration, down from 49% last March. With midterms looming, those numbers have spooked Trump's brain trust, said Alex Eisenstadt and Mark Caputo in Axios. Even Trump himself, according to one advisor, has expressed some discomfort over ICE's conduct. Trump wants mass deportation, said the source. What he doesn't want is what people are seeing. Trump is uncomfortable, said Chris Brennan in USA Today, only because Americans aren't taking the bait of ICE's provocations. His ultimate desire, the unrealized dream of his first term, is to invade America's city with America's military, putting Democratic strongholds and pivotal swing state districts under his control. For that to happen, he needs ICE to provoke civil unrest, giving him a pretext to trigger the Insurrection Act. But so far, the only violence we're seeing is from ICE, which leaves Trump stuck. ICE's stormtrooper raids are not primarily about immigration, said Greg Sargent in the New Republic. This is a campaign of deliberate terror, designed in part, yes, to encourage illegal migrants to self-deport. But mainly it's to send a warning to ordinary Americans that if we resist Trump's agenda, our citizenship will grant us no more protection than it did Rene Good. It's time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for thin air, after business analysts projected that the popularity of GLP-1 weight loss drugs could save the top four U.S. airlines, American, Delta, Southwest, and United, as much as $580 million annually because lighter passengers require less fuel to get airborne. It's a good week for togetherness, after Philip Nitschke, inventor of the Sarko-assisted suicide capsule, announced plans for the Double Dutch Sarko, a two-seat capsule that would let couples end their lives together. The Double Dutch will feature two separate activation buttons, both of which must be pressed before the capsule floods with deadly nitrogen. It's a good week for contingencies, after a former policy expert at the Bank of England advised the central bank to plan for an announcement confirming the existence of alien life. Such a disclosure, said Helen McCraw, could trigger extreme market volatility due to catastrophizing or euphoria. But it was a bad week for California. After a Danish petition to buy the remote, resource-rich western state from the U.S., attracted more than 200,000 signatures. The petition, motivated by Trump's threat to annex Greenland, calls for California to be renamed New Denmark, and Disneyland to become Hans Christian Andersen Land. It's a bad week for dinner after Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins assured Americans that despite rising grocery prices, healthy meals are still affordable. For an outlay of only $3, said Rollins, Americans can enjoy a piece of chicken, a piece of broccoli, you know, a corn tortilla, and one other thing. Finally, it was a bad week for idols after a Filipino woman spent 4 years praying to what she believed was a small green figurine of a smiling, rotund Buddha, only to be informed by a cinephile friend that she'd been worshiping a 3D printed figure of Shrek, the affable cartoon ogre. Briefing this week is titled Dominating the Americas. President Trump has revived the 19th century Monroe Doctrine to justify his aggressive foreign policy. What is the Monroe Doctrine? It's a foreign policy vision that was first articulated by President James Monroe in 1823. Monroe declared that the Western Hemisphere was off limits to European colonization and that political meddling in the Americas by old world powers would be considered a threat to U.S. peace and safety. This policy, which in the 1850s became known as the Monroe Doctrine, landed after a decade-long stretch in which Venezuela, Mexico, Guatemala, and a dozen other former Spanish colonies in the Americas had won independence and opened their once closed ports to American and British trade. With rumors circulating that Spain might try to reconquer its New World possessions, and with Russia claiming control of the Pacific coast from Alaska to Oregon, both Washington and London were keen to protect their hemispheric interest. The two powers discussed a joint declaration opposing further European intervention in the Americas, but Secretary of State John Quincy Adams objected, saying the U.S. should act unilaterally rather than come in and as a cockboat in the wake of the British man of war. And so, in December 1823, Monroe told Congress that the Americans are henceforth not to be considered as subjects for future colonization by any European powers. Did the other countries take that warning seriously? Not initially. The young U.S. was not yet a major military power, making Monroe's policy much more of an aspirational goal than a declaration of capacity, said Britta Crandall, a political scientist at Davidson College. It didn't stop the French and British navies from blockading Argentina's La Plata River from 1838 to 1850, or the French from invading Mexico and installing a puppet monarch, the Austrian-born Maximilian I, while the U.S. was distracted by the American Civil War. It was only as the century came to an end that the U.S. started to meaningfully enforce the doctrine. It was invoked in the 1898 Spanish-American War, when the U.S. helped liberate Cuba from Spanish rule and secured control of Madrid's former possessions of Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines. Emboldened by that victory, President Theodore Roosevelt would radically expand the doctrine after taking office in 1901. How did he change it? When British, German, and Italian gunboats blockaded Venezuelan ports in 1902 to collect debts, Roosevelt told the Europeans to quickly strike a deal with the dictatorship in Caracas or else see an American fleet dispatched against their ships. The Europeans heeded the warning, but Roosevelt didn't want the U.S. to become a shield for the region's corrupt rulers who, he said, deserved a spank. So in 1904, he laid out what became known as the Roosevelt Corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. The U.S., he said, must act as international police power to keep America's backyard stable, orderly, and prosperous. It was the start of a new era of American interventionism. What happened? From 1903 to 1934, the U.S. Marines were deployed to a half dozen countries in the hemisphere. They included Honduras, where American troops were sent seven times to quell revolutions, Nicaragua, which was occupied nearly continuously from 1912 to 1933, and the Dominican Republic, where Marines installed a pro-American president in 1916 and occupied the country for the next 8 years. A primary goal was to protect the interests of U.S. companies such as United Fruit, which controlled the trade in bananas, sugarcane, and other goods. A powerhouse in Washington, the company backed coups against elected governments and the installation of accommodating puppet governments, or, quote, banana republics. These occupations became military quagmires in which hundreds of U.S. soldiers and tens of thousands of civilians were killed. These are the forever wars of their era, said historian J. Sexton. They begin to become very, very unpopular in the U.S. In 1933, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt put an end to the banana wars era with his good neighbor policy, which stressed regional cooperation over military force. Did that policy last? For a while. But the Monroe Doctrine was resurrected with the start of the Cold War and invoked to combat the spread of Soviet-style communism across Latin America. In 1954, shortly after CIA-backed insurgents toppled Guatemala's leftist government, Secretary of State John F. Dulles said the intrusion of Soviet despotism into the country was a direct challenge to our Monroe Doctrine, the first and most fundamental of our foreign policies. Over the following decades, the U.S. would covertly support the overthrow of leftist governments in Bolivia, Cuba, Chile, and Nicaragua. Such meddling fell out of favor with the collapse of the Soviet Union, and in 2013, then-Secretary of State John Kerry won the applause when he told an audience of Latin American officials, "The era of the Monroe Doctrine is over." But President Trump, who keeps a portrait of Monroe near his Oval Office desk, has brought it back to life, calling his approach to foreign policy the Monroe Doctrine. What does Trump's doctrine involve? In its recent national security strategy document, his administration laid out a Trump corollary, declaring its intent to combat mass migration, drug trafficking, and hostile foreign incursion or ownership of key assets in the hemisphere. The administration soon followed through with the removal of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, whom it accused of shipping drugs to the U.S. and hosting foreign adversaries, and Trump's subsequent assertion that the U.S. would run Venezuela. Trump is now threatening to use military force in Mexico and Colombia to take back control of the U.S.-built Panama Canal, and to buy or forcibly annex Greenland. The Monroe Doctrine was very important, but we forgot about it, Trump said this month. We don't forget about it anymore. Time for a few of the best columns. First up is the GOP's health care fallacy. President Trump has been promising since 2017 a spectacular new health care plan to replace the Affordable Care Act, said Paul Waldman. Now that enhanced Obamacare subsidies have expired, sending premiums soaring for millions of Americans, the White House finally announced Trump's great health care plan last week. but it's neither great nor a real plan. Instead, it's a bunch of vague statements of principle based on the longstanding Republican fallacy that the simple solution to all health care problems is the free market. Trump proposes redirecting government subsidies for insurance into a direct payment to consumers, allowing them to use that money to shop for insurance and doctors. But getting your gallbladder removed is not like buying a car. When you have a heart attack, you don't go online to compare prices for emergency rooms and cardiac surgeons. In the real world, health care is not an optional consumer good. People want the best care, not the cheapest. Trump knows almost nothing about health care, so he allows right-wing ideologues to handle the issue. Their cruel plan is to degrade or eliminate health insurance for millions of Americans and let them figure out how to pay doctors and hospitals or do without care. This is a How They See Us column from Europe. Is this the end of NATO? They should have just given Donald Trump the Nobel Peace Prize, said Charles Moore. In his petulant letter to Norway's prime minister, the U.S. president confirmed that it was the Nobel snub that put him over the edge in his demand that Denmark cede Greenland. Anyway, it's too late now, and the existence of NATO is in doubt. While Denmark and several other NATO countries have sent small contingents of soldiers to Greenland, they won't be much use against the mighty might of a superpower that demands its way. It has come to this. The U.S., the head of the Transatlantic Defense Alliance, is actually threatening to invade a member state. While Trump backtracked at Davos, saying he wouldn't use military force, who can trust him? Nothing justifies Trump's demand for territory when Greenlanders are marching through the streets to make it clear they do not want to become American. European leaders tried flattery and obsequiousness, but Trump respects only those who fight back. And Europe has no shortage of arms, provided it will finally decides to use them. We can't afford to capitulate, said Henrik Højgaard Sejerkild. We are defending fundamental rights to self-determination against Trump's pure bully totalitarianism. But that doesn't mean anyone needs to fire a shot. Remember, most of what Trump says is bullshit, and his bluff can be called. Europe, with its vast economy, could make Trump feel the pain of a trade war, and it could boycott the World Cup he is hosting this summer. A World Cup without Germany, England, and France is not a World Cup. That will hit Trump where it hurts the most, his vanity. For Russians, this is a joy to watch, said Dmitry Popov. Denmark waited for decades for Russia to invade its semi-autonomous Arctic island, only to discover the real enemy was Trump's America. The chief of the madhouse has gone crazy. It's doubly sweet because Trump didn't need to humiliate Europe so much just to secure Greenland. Under a 1951 U.S. treaty with Denmark, he could have loaded up the island with whatever military installations he wished. But Trump hates alliances. NATO means nothing to him. The Europeans are now so desperate they've actually begun to consider the idea of negotiating with Russia. This is an unprecedented reversal of the system of alliances and international rules, said Ayokoko Ada. The most powerful country in the world is being led by a septuagenarian living in a narcissistic dream where everything is owed to him, a greedy mafioso who launches a violent hunt for foreigners in the streets of American cities. Nothing restrains him. If he can take Greenland's minerals, who's to say Norway's oil and gas won't be next? He sees Europe as a colonizable space. This grotesque escalation over Greenland could not only finish off NATO forever, the greatest wish of his mentor Vladimir Putin, it could even trigger conflict between the U.S. and Europe. The worst-case scenario, an agreement between Russia and the U.S. against Europe, is possible, even probable. This is an international column from Gaza. Phase 2, make Israel do phase one. The U.S. says phase two of the Gaza ceasefire deal has begun, but implementing it will be an almost impossible task, said Ibrahim Malem. Phase two of the U.S. brokered deal tasks a committee of Palestinian technocrats with the massive challenge of managing Gaza. These 15 people will have to sidestep landmines of pretexts that Israel has concocted to evade its phase one obligations, which include withdrawing its military to the agreed line, removing the rubble, beginning reconstruction, and opening the Rafah border crossing in both directions. Without these measures, starving Palestinian families cannot get enough food and medicine to survive. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu excuses his stalling by saying there can be no progress until Hamas surrenders its weapons, which is a phase two obligation, or until the return of the last hostage seized on October 7, 2023, Ron Gvili, whose body is being held by Islamic Jihad, not Hamas. A Gaza committee, even one staffed with nationally known figures, as this one is unlikely to succeed in these circumstances. Yet it has no choice but to try. Hundreds of thousands of Gazans are living unprotected from winter, the cold winds battering their tents. At least 8 babies have frozen to death. We can bear no more. The last word, our feature article, tunnel vision. A Brazilian journalist is convinced that a network of Nazi hideouts lies buried beneath his hometown, said Terrence McCoy in the Washington Post. Will he ever unearth the truth? Looking up at the darkened edifice, the gumshoe thought he was on the cusp of his big break. For years, the house off the town square in Ibiruba had fascinated and tormented him. He'd interviewed dozens of residents, pored over old newspaper clippings, and spent every spare cent in pursuit of what he believed was a secret, shameful history buried beneath it. But Clovis Messerschmidt had never been inside the house. Not until that night in 2022, the night before it was to be demolished. It was his final chance to bring back definitive proof of a story he had staked his journalistic credibility on, that several prominent inhabitants of this ethnically German town in southern Brazil had been Nazi sympathizers, and that they'd hidden fugitives fleeing from Nazi hunters and the collapse of the Third Reich in a clandestine tunnel system. Messerschmidt, 45, the publisher, editor, and lead reporter of In Folk, a local magazine with a circulation of 1,000, waited until well past midnight. Then he and two fellow sleuths made their move. The three men recalled in interviews, hopping the wall, climbing the porch, and reaching the front door. It had been left unlocked. I was super nervous, recalled Fabio Bueno, who shared his friend's obsession. A lot of people didn't want us to discover what was there. Messerschmidt led the way, taking a brazen step deeper into a saga that has consumed his life and divided his hometown. Since 2015, when he published his first piece on the alleged Nazi tunnels running beneath the town, Ibiruba has turned itself inside out in search of them. There have been town council motions, official excavations, university research expeditions, and national media stories, as well as alleged death threats, conspiracies, and cover-ups. Enthusiasts even vandalized the grave of a leading figure in the purported tunnel plot to determine if he'd faked his own death. And he may have. It is a surprisingly common drama in this part of Brazil, where the blank pages of history on South America's Nazi diaspora have been filled with urban legend. German officials have estimated that about 9,000 Nazis fled to the continent following World War II. About 5,000 went to Argentina. Somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 headed to Brazil. Their number famously included Josef Mengele, Auschwitz's Angel of Death, who died in the Brazilian coastal town of Bertioga in 1979. But from there, historians say, the story of Brazil's fugitive Nazis and the people who protected them is clouded by uncertainty, false information, and ever-multiplying conspiracy theories. It's a collective delirium, said Ibiruba broadcaster Carlos Cesar. People want to believe. Few have believed more fervently than Messerschmidt. He's dedicated years to research and has interviewed more than 100 people who say they either know of or have entered the supposed tunnels. So on that night 3 years ago, he made his move. The three men scoured the historic Brown family home, which had been sold and vacated, in search of a trapdoor that Messerschmidt's sources had spoken of. After several long, tense minutes, the men said they found what they'd come for. They pulled up the trapdoor and descended the wooden steps until they found themselves in an underground bunker. This room would branch into separate corridors, they had been told, with each feeding into a larger tunnel system. But to their profound frustration, Messerschmidt and his companions hit a dead end. Someone who had lined the bunker with concrete walls staggered in height, the men said. They appeared to be recently built and, to the enthusiast, inexplicable. No one put them there because they were beautiful, Loreno Bueno reasoned. Someone wanted to conceal something. The Brown home was soon destroyed and a high-rise put in its place, erasing the access point to the alleged tunnels. It was a huge blow to our research, Messerschmidt mourned. But if anything, the failure of that night further galvanized him. There were Nazi tunnels down there, he was sure of it. This, he said, is a search for truth. Like most natives of Ibiruba, a prosperous town whose German roots reach back to the late 1800s, Messerschmidt had grown up hearing the stories of underground tunnels. But he had never paid much attention until 2015, when he started working on a special edition of Infolk, which he runs out of his house to celebrate the town's official 60th anniversary. One story, he wrote, delved into the enduring suspicion that one of the town's central historical figures, Federico Ernesto Brown, had faked his own death. The doctor's body had perspired during the funeral in 1964, rumor had it. Other locals had reported hearing noises from inside the coffin. During his reporting, Messerschmidt realized the elderly people he interviewed were sincere in their convictions, not just that Braun had faked his death, but that there were tunnels underneath his home. These were serious, honest people, he said. They stood to gain nothing from lying. In April 2015, he began publishing one story after another. The pieces landed with greater impact than anything in folk until then, mostly preoccupied with town pageants and store openings, had ever published. Other residents quickly came forward, including former domestic employee Francisca Schofer, who has since died. She claimed the doctor and other prominent Ibiruba residents had been Nazi sympathizers. She had personally entered the tunnels, she told Messerschmidt, which were built to hide contraband goods and Nazi fugitives. Some thought it was all a lie. Others saw it as confirmation of stories they'd heard as children. So Messerschmidt pressed on with what he came to call my mission. He scrutinized decades-old newspaper stories and discovered that Ibiruba had, in fact, hosted a cell of Nazi sympathizers. But his most startling discoveries were about Brown. In the early 1960s, the physician had been publicly accused by his American wife of leading an international money laundering syndicate that allegedly brought more than $40 million from the U.S. into Brazil. The allegations, which Brown denied, caused a frenzy in the Brazilian press. The Ultima Hora newspaper reported that Interpol was investigating Brown's international gang, which involved dozens of people. Another outlet said the findings had been passed along to the FBI. A theory began to take shape in Messerschmitt's head. Braun, under investigation by the FBI, had constructed tunnels under the town to hide Nazi fugitives and conceal his own nefarious doings. Messerschmitt's subsequent stories in Infolk led to additional clues. One enthusiast gave him a picture he claimed to have discovered while rummaging through the Browns' family trash years before. It showed Braun's father, the cousin of Hitler's companion Eva Braun, according to one of Messerschmitt's sources, fraternizing with a man in what Messerschmitt concluded was a Nazi uniform. In 2016, an unidentified truther and his son descended upon Braun's sepulcher in the town cemetery. They lifted up the stone covering, extracted a tibia bone, and sent a letter to Cesar, the local journalist, explaining where he could find the doctor's purported tibia. "I decided to help the press with the history of Iburuba," the letter said. "I want the truth." The tibia bone was sent by police for forensic analysis. Weeks later came the results, which the Post reviewed. The bone had belonged to a man of African, not European, descent. Dr. Braun, Messerschmitt trumpeted in an interview with the Post, faked his own death. More than 180 miles away in the state capital of Porto Alegre, René Gertz, one of the nation's leading historians on Nazism in southern Brazil, was watching the drama in Ibirubá with mounting consternation. He knew that Eva Braun didn't have any confirmed close relatives in South America, and the photo that allegedly showed Dr. Braun's father with a Nazi, to Gertz, it was just an anonymous man in a black military garb. As for the tunnels, it wasn't just historically improbable, it seemed physically impossible. Ibirubá's soil is dense, fertile, and largely free of rocks and pebbles. That makes it perfect for growing soy, but quite poor, he said, for tunnel construction. To Gertz, it was just one more southern Brazilian town in the grip of Nazi conspiracy theories. The residents of Candido, Godoy, for instance, believed its abnormally high rate of twins was due to experiments by Mengele, who had purportedly passed through. Nearly 400 miles north, in Medical Candido Rondon, locals contended that one of Hitler's allies had constructed tunnels beneath his mansion. Academic inquiry had debunked it all. Gertz soon became one of Messerschmitt's most public critics. In a blog post, he called the supposed Nazi tunnels both questionable and problematic. Although he wrote dryly, he wouldn't deny someone their right to conquer a few minutes of fame by spreading theories about exotic things. Messerschmitt bristled at the criticism. The guy never set foot on, much less dug an inch into, Ibirubá land, but he wants to trivialize the work of the press and the testimonies of more than 100 eyewitnesses. There was only one way to silence the doubters, the journalist believed. He first persuaded a team of researchers from the Federal University of Rio Grande do Sul to perform a groundbreaking penetrating radar analysis of the area where sources told him the tunnels were hidden. Then, after they discovered several anomalies that were possible indications of tunnels, according to a subsequent report, he called on the town to help solve the mystery. One morning in May 2019, Messerschmitt claimed, he descended the stairs to Infolk's newsroom to find an envelope under the door. "Don't go past the limits. Fear for those you love and don't expose yourself. They know where you live and are watching your and your family's steps, said the note, which Messerschmitt forwarded to the police and national media. When the tunnels are opened, much will be found. That October, the people of Ibn Rubah gathered just off the town square to see the truth for themselves. Let's finish this story, intoned then-Mayor Abel Grave. Municipal excavators dug into the ground where the researchers had identified the anomalies. People peered into the large black hole. A firefighter was lowered into the darkness. At the bottom, he found something. But it wasn't the brick tunnel that Messerschmitt had envisioned. It was a large, hollow concrete tube, an unused plumbing line. The town decided to investigate no further. The hole was closed. Traffic resumed in downtown Ibn Rubah. After everything, the failed excavation, the unsuccessful incursion into the brown house, the menacing letter, Messerschmitt's wife, Glaciana, believed her husband would finally give up. To her, there didn't seem to be anything left to investigate. But he couldn't let go. Obsessed is the word people use to describe him, she said. He wants to prove to the people that his sources aren't lying, and that's why he says he has to continue. Messerschmitt kept publishing follow-ups and scrounged for additional sources. One was Leonilda Brunieri, 72, who said she'd been befriended by the Braun family as a girl and had frequently entered the tunnels. Inside, she said, was abundant Nazi paraphernalia. In an interview with the Post in September, she recalled an iron door engraved with a swastika. There were so many Nazi things, she said. For months, Messerschmitt had promised he would soon, at long last, expose the network that his sources had described. He said he was partnering with additional researchers from Pampa Federal University. He said the local government was on board. Maybe the dig would happen in July of this year, or September, or October. But when the Post contacted the university researchers and town officials, they all reacted with surprise. Not only was there no imminent dig, they said, there was no dig planned at all. When pressed on this and other discrepancies, Messerschmitt didn't back down. He said he was missing just one last legal authorization to proceed. It was all true, he insisted. Ibn Rubah was a Nazi hub, and it had attracted some of the Third Reich's most notorious criminals, and they had hidden in tunnels he would soon uncover. It was the tale he told again in his recent documentary, posted on YouTube in July, which has garnered more than 133,000 views. What began as a story to celebrate the town's 60th anniversary, he wrote in the opening, has transformed into a tireless search for answers. Referring to himself in the third person, he continued, Clovis has been able to demystify the myth. This article was first published in the Washington Post. Here's a technology article for you. AI, the reason your energy bills are rising. Massive windowless buildings are springing up around the world, said Angie Gosh in Bloomberg. Some of the newest ones cover an area comparable to Central Park in Manhattan. These aren't malls or prisons. They're data centers housing acres of servers to handle artificial intelligence computations. And they're increasingly hogging local resources. A typical AI data center can use about 530,000 gallons of water a day and enough electricity to power roughly 750,000 homes for the fans it requires for cooling. Consumers are already starting to pay the price. U.S. wholesale electricity costs are 260 67% higher than 5 years ago in areas near large data centers. And the grid is being strained by all the additional usage. President Trump last week joined with the governors of Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Virginia to push the nation's largest electricity grid operator, PJM Interconnection, to auction off contracts to tech companies to pay for new power plants. There's a bipartisan consensus forming around data centers, said Matt Honan in MIT Technology Review. Everyone hates them. You can see it at uproarious town halls in states from Virginia to South Dakota, where data centers are top of mind for voters. In Georgia, the purplest of purple states, some 900 people showed up to voice opposition to a proposed data center near Bolingbroke, population 492. The would-be developers of the project claimed it would bring in millions of dollars for the county. But residents were already seeing skyrocketing power bills attributed to the state's AI building boom. Data center moratoriums are the new fracking ban, said Peter Huntsman in the Wall Street Journal. Like it or not, AI is the lifeblood of economic prosperity and global power, and data centers are the factories of the 21st century economy, converting energy into processing capacity the way refineries convert oil into gas. But environmental groups are deploying the same playbook against data centers that they use to vilify oil, gas, nuclear, and chemical companies without any attempt to reconcile the economic ramifications. Tech companies know data centers have a political problem, said Gabby Miller in Politico, and they are working hard to spin it. One AI lobbyist has been distributing talking points to members of Congress and organizing local data center field trips to better pitch voters on their value. Well, what happens if the AI bubble bursts, said Lauren Good in Wired. Silicon Valley is in the fever dream days of generative AI. Nobody is willing to admit that building these warehouses might be an overshoot, either ecologically or economically. Many of our tech overlords are obsessed with the Roman Empire, which spanned one-ninth of the Earth's circumference. They should remember that even Rome eventually collapsed. And one of the Talking Points articles, trans athletes, should they be banned? The Supreme Court has the chance to save women's sports, said the Washington Post in an editorial. The justices heard arguments last week in two cases challenging Idaho and West Virginia laws blocking transgender women and girls from participating in female sports. 25 other states have similar laws. Lawyers for two trans girls argued the bans violated their constitutional rights under the Equal Protection Clause and the Civil Rights Act, a position the court's conservative majority seemed prepared to reject, and for good reason. Girls and boys compete separately in sports because of distinct biological differences. Males have bigger bones, stronger muscles, and more aerobic capacity than females, and many studies indicate those advantages persist after hormone treatments. The huge growth of girls' sports programs was one of feminism's greatest victories, but letting biological boys compete against girls would roll back that progress. That's bigoted nonsense, said Ellie Mistel in The Nation. Conservatives have ginned up a crusade against trans athletes, pretending it's about protecting women and girls. First of all, the NCAA says that trans students accounted for roughly 10 of the 500,000 collegiate athletes in 2024. Secondly, the tiny number of trans girls and women who compete do not pose an unfair safety risk to cisgender female athletes. Both male and female athletes frequently differ in height, weight, and strength, and nobody gives a damn when a 17-year-old defensive lineman who's 6'4" and 285 pounds concusses a 5'8", 150-pound freshman. But if a slightly bigger trans girl athlete knocks down an opposing player, a national inquiry must be launched into the girl's pants. The issue presents a real conundrum, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg. Girls' sports need to be protected, but a total national ban would be demeaning to the dignity of transgender girls. The plaintiff's lawyers presented a third alternative, a case-by-case system, in which individual trans athletes can show that their medical treatments have eliminated any physiological advantage. This is the single most difficult issue in women's sports, said Sally Jenkins in The Atlantic. People like me can support trans civil rights with their whole heart, but also worry a meaningful number of women may be harmed by transgender inclusion. For that reason, the Supreme Court should avoid a broad national ruling and let the states and science continue to sort this out. One of the short notes, House members cast only 362 votes last year, the lowest in a quarter century except for 2020, the first full year of the COVID-19 pandemic. That was also the fewest votes cast in a non-election year since 1990. On the poll watch, 58% of Americans called the first year of President Trump's second term a failure. Just 36% say he has the right priorities, and only 37% say that Trump puts the good of the country above his personal gain. 35% say they're proud that he's president. And we'll finish today's show with a quote from Robert Ingersoll, quoted in Vanguard, who says, "Nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.